This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Energy Bill and America's Future. Hello again, I'm Marvin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Congress has passed the energy bill. If the Senate does too, President Bush says he'll sign it this weekend. It's a massive piece of legislation, but all that ordinary Americans are likely to see is an extension of daylight savings. Even supporters concede the bill won't cut gasoline prices or reduce dependence on foreign oil. It bypasses global climate change altogether. On To the Point, we'll hear about tax breaks and loan guarantees for producers of oil, gas, nuclear power, and ethanol. Is it a blueprint for a safer America or a missed opportunity? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the IRA says it'll lay down its arms. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Congress has passed the energy bill and sent it on to the Senate. President Bush wants to sign it this weekend. On To the Point, will billions in tax breaks and loan guarantees cut gasoline prices or reduce dependence on foreign oil? Will the bill make America safer? On Reporter's Notebook, the IRA says it'll end 35 years of violence and pursue independence from Britain by exclusively peaceful means. We'll hear from Ireland. First, this news update. The shuttle Discovery has docked with the International Space Station, but not before it performed a kind of backflip maneuver so cameras could assess the possible damage from Tuesday's launch. Michael Cabbage is author of Com Check, the final flight of Shuttle Columbia. He reports for the Orlando Sentinel. Michael, good to have you back with us. The shuttles now have been grounded because of what happened on Tuesday. What does that mean for the astronauts in Discovery who are now in orbit and who are going to be thinking about reentry very soon?
Probably doesn't mean a whole lot for the astronauts that are actually on board Discovery in orbit right now, unless by some chance they should discover that they have damage to their vehicle and would need a rescue mission to come retrieve them. As you know, there is a provision now since the Columbia accident that shuttle is kept on standby to come up and get astronauts from the International Space Station if they find their vehicle is damaged. But barring that remote possibility, the real impact is going to be on down the road later this year, next year, when other shuttle flights were scheduled to fly, and now they might not.
Before we get to that, back to the question of the foam that came off on Tuesday. That was the same problem that you explored so extensively in your book and that led to the Columbia disaster. Why is this not thought to happen again, even though the same thing took place?
Well, foam insulation on the shuttle's external fuel tank has fallen off of the tank every launch in the shuttle program's history, and it will continue to fall off for every launch in the shuttle program's history. It's one of those things that is inherent in the design. NASA managers and people in the shuttle program freely admit that they're never going to be able to stop this from happening. But what they had hoped to do was to minimize it and to reduce the chance of foam coming off from critical places on the fuel tank where it could damage Discovery. And it appears from the photos that they're getting back from orbit that they haven't done that.
How about, then, those future launches that you mentioned a moment ago, and to what extent does this put them at risk?
Well, that's the big question right now. I mean, clearly NASA is going to have to do something to fix the tank again before it can fly again. There's a ramp on the side of the tank that's next to a fuel line and some electrical cables that is where one large piece of foam came off from again during the launch on Tuesday. And NASA had actually talked about removing that ramp before they flew this mission, but they decided instead that they would wait for a couple of flights. Now it appears likely that they're certainly going to have to do that before they launch again. And that probably is going to take at least a few months to do that.
Talking with Michael Cabbage, who is at Houston at Mission Control. What is the atmosphere there like now, given what happened and in the aftermath of the launch, which took place even though they hadn't fixed the fuel sensor problem?
Well, there's no question. There's huge disappointment here in the shuttle program at Johnson Space Center, as there is in the people who work for the shuttle program everywhere else. This was going to be their moment of triumph when they finally returned the shuttle to flight after a 2.5 year absence. And then, you know, the day after, actually the afternoon of the launch, there's an indication that, again, this foam problem had recurred. And it was just a case of, you know, going from ecstasy to sort of, you know, agony in a very short period of time.
Well, those flights that you mentioned earlier, the future launches, were designed to complete the International Space Station. What are the prospects now that it ever will be completed?
Well, that's another really good question, and I think it's a bit early to really sort of draw any real conclusions about that. But clearly there's going to be a reexamination of the shuttle's future and how many more missions the shuttle is going to fly. And what other options are available to eventually build and support the International Space Station. And I think it's going to be interesting over the next few months to see how that debate unfolds. And it's not a discussion that's going to be limited to NASA only. It's a discussion that ultimately the White House and Congress are going to have to get involved in as well.
A lot of people have been skeptical about the usefulness of the International Space Station. The president is already talking about getting onto the moon and Mars. So does it appear there might be more focus on that than there will be on getting future shuttles in the air?
You never know. And I mean, that's certainly a possibility, that given the latest problem with the shuttle, undoubtedly, there will be some people that will ask the question, if we are continuing to have these sorts of problems with the shuttle and we're continuing to drop resources into a vehicle that we already plan to retire by 2010, does that make sense, or does it make sense to move on to the next new thing? And I think that question is probably going to be asked a lot in the next few weeks.
All right. We'll be trying to attend to that. And thanks for helping us out with it, Michael Cabbage, aerospace editor of the Orlando Sentinel, reporting today from Houston. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
The energy bill and America's future in just a moment on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. Congress has passed the energy bill and sent it on to the Senate. Republican leaders call it a great first major step toward energy independence, but even a lot of supporters have serious reservations. John Fialka reports on energy and the environment for the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. And John, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
What was the debate like, or was there much debate, as it finally came down to approving this joint version of the bill worked out with Senate negotiators?
It was pretty anticlimactic. We're all pretty tired of this bill by now. It's 1,700 pages long, and we've heard all the arguments about five times, so it wasn't much of an event today.
So what are the major arguments that are still raging over this 1,700-page bill? That's about the size of the phone directory.
Well, Democrats will say that it doesn't do anything to lower prices at the gas pump, which I think is kind of a false rap, because Congress is powerful, but it really doesn't have a magic wand. And that one is unsolvable in the short term. We will continue to remain dependent on foreign oil, and the foreigners set the price.
So what? That's the only issue that the Democrats have with?
Oh, no. There are lots more issues. I mean, this will reverberate for a long time. There are $12.3 billion worth of incentives in this bill for various energy industries. The two biggest ones would support the use of clean coal and nuclear power as an alternative to natural gas, which, as you know, is in short supply and getting very expensive. But the political argument there is that this is all pork, and this is just giving money to the big oil companies, which are already fat with profits. And that's an argument that resonates with some parts of the Democrats and will probably resonate forever.
Even some Republicans, though, didn't want to vote for this bill.
Well, let's see. Most of them did, as it turned out. There is a fringe of the party on the East Coast, the moderates. Some of them didn't like some aspects of it. But you've got a pretty strong vote here, 275 to 156. And I think the vote tomorrow in the Senate will be the same, with no filibuster.
Again, we're talking with John Fialca, who's covering energy and the environment for The Wall Street Journal. What about the aspects of this that ordinary Americans are likely to see? Certainly one of them is the extension of daylight savings. When does that happen, and how long will it be extended?
It's being extended 3 weeks earlier into the spring and a week later into the fall. They'll probably see the best benefit of it on Halloween, where kids, little kids, can go trick-or-treating at dusk rather than in the darkness. This is touted as an energy savings measure, but the savings are pretty small. It's more of a kind of feel-good measure, I think.
What about the incentives for people who buy hybrids and who try to make their homes more efficient? What are they, and what's it going to take to get them?
Well, they're short-lived. The maximum is only 2 years before Congress cuts it back. But it's a big benefit for people who are interested in these things. The tax credits are up to 30% of the costs of, say, putting solar equipment on your house. And that is a big goodie, but it doesn't last long. It lasts for about 2 years, and then it goes down to, I believe, 10%.
What about the hybrid cars? Does that extend to people who already have them, or do you have to get a new one in order to get the incentive?
There's incentives for buyers, but there are also incentives for American companies who want to build them. And the hope is that more companies this technology will spread and contribute to lowering demands on gasoline, which is one of the things that Congress can do.
You said that you thought it was kind of a bad rap to say that it won't lower the price of gasoline at the pump. What about making the country less dependent on foreign oil?
Well, again, we get to, you know, how do we do that? With this Congress, you have the automakers lobbying so successfully that they have run away from anything that looks like an effort to make them produce more efficient cars. You can just see it on both floors of the House and the Senate that they are scared to death of that and won't touch it. So the only other way to go, I guess, is to offer incentives to buyers to buy fuel-efficient cars, and that's what they've done.
All right. Well, we're going to have some conversation about this as our program continues. Meantime, thanks for giving us an update on the debate today in the House. John Fialca, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Again, with the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. Bill Prindle is Deputy Director of the American Council for an Energy-Efficient Economy. Bill Prindle, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Quickly, tell us a bit about your council. It's billed as nonpartisan. Who supports it? What is it?
We're a small nonprofit group. Our foundation support comes from foundations, some government grants, and a mixture of conference revenues and miscellaneous research contracts.
Okay. Once again, it's the American Council for an Energy-Efficient Economy. Will the economy be more energy efficient as a result of this bill?
Well, about 2%. We calculate that the total efficiency impacts in the bill will reduce energy use in 2020 by about 2% below what the current forecast is.
So is that enough?
Well, no. That's the bad news. Our analysis shows that a stronger bill could produce savings more in the range of 8%, which would really start to make a dent in things like oil dependence, energy prices, and so forth.
What would it take to get to 8% that's not in this bill?
Well, you have to start with restoring the Senate's target for saving 1 million barrels of oil a day. That was in the Senate bill. It was dropped in conference. You'd need to restore the provision that was in the Senate bill that would have asked states to look at efficiency resource standards for utilities the way Texas, President Bush, when he was governor, signed a bill in 1999 that said the utilities have to offset their load growth through energy efficiency, and other states are taking that up. That could have saved a lot of energy. Things as simple as Senator Schumer's amendment to create efficiency standards for tires. A number of things could have helped.
Earlier, we heard John Fialca of the Wall Street Journal say that the auto industry's lobby was so powerful that there's no effort at all to make automobiles more efficient. How much could there, or what would that have to do with getting toward that 8%? How much more efficient would they have to be?
Well, by our estimation, if we could achieve an average fuel economy in the total fleet, that's passenger vehicles and light trucks, of 40 miles per gallon, which we found is very cost-effective to do. If we could do that by 2020, we would be saving in the order of 3 million barrels of oil a day, which is, you know, more than 10% of total U.S. oil demand. That would start to make a real dent in oil imports.
There is a story today in the New York Times that says the Environmental Protection Agency made an 11th-hour decision on Tuesday to delay the planned release of an annual report on fuel economy, which says that as a result of loopholes in fuel economy regulations, automakers are producing cars and trucks that are significantly less fuel efficient on average than they were in the late 1980s. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, that's an unfortunate fact. The average fleet fuel economy for American vehicles today is about 6% less than it was in the late 80s. That's because SUVs and light trucks have to meet a lower fuel economy standard, and they've had an increasing share of the market. Also, there's things like getting fuel economy credit for building a car that can run on ethanol fuel, whether or not it actually ever burns any ethanol fuel. So, you know, there's as much as one or two miles per gallon of fuel economy is being sacrificed to that kind of loophole.
Well, now, you said that there's only a 2% greater efficiency as a result of this bill. Are you taking into consideration the new tax breaks and incentives for nuclear power and for clean coal? If, in fact, they developed as hoped, might they lead to greater efficiency?
Yeah, that's not part of our calculation. We were simply trying to look at the effect on total energy use, whether it's met through nuclear, coal, gas, oil, or other fuels, is another analysis.
There's a lot of concern, particularly about nuclear power. It's being opposed by people for a lot of different reasons. Is your organization, the Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, supportive of nuclear as an alternative to what we have now?
We don't take positions on specific supply technologies. What we would like to see, however, is that there be a level playing field in the way these resources are analyzed and the way they're subsidized, so that we would not like to see huge subsidies thrown into one particular technology area, which has the way of has the effect of distorting markets and also penalizing other technologies which could make important contributions to the mix.
What about the way that this bill allocates its benefits?
Well, the Senate bill we thought was more even-handed. The tax incentives in the Senate were more equally divided between renewables efficiency and conventional supply technologies. What we're seeing in the conference bill is a bit more of a swing towards the conventional energy supply technologies, and you know, we think that's a bit out of balance. We also understand the power that the supply industries have in Congress these days.
Okay, Bill Prindle, once again, Deputy Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Ray Dewar is Manager of Energy Market Issues for the American Petroleum Institute. Ray Dewar, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you.
I guess your industry could be called, and I think this is what Bill Prindle meant, the conventional energy supply industry. How do you feel about this bill?
Well, we think it's a good first step, but there's a lot more to be done. And so that's kind of where we come down on it. We'd like to see more supplies of oil and gas developed, and this legislation really didn't address that. And we still would like to see more done in the refining and distribution sector of the industry. And so there were some disappointments in the bill itself, and but we do think it's better than nothing. And it really, in looking to the future, we need to bring a lot more supply into the marketplace of all kinds of fuels. And we do need to address our demand as well. If we want to keep having reliable, affordable supplies of energy, we have to do both. We need to be better conservation, and we need to be better at delivering fuels than we are. So there were some pluses, some minuses. It depends on how you want to look at this. Your cup is either half full or half empty here. And we're looking to move forward and with some other features of the legislation and hope to see more production coming online in the future.
How do you feel at the American Petroleum Institute about this issue of more efficient automobiles and trucks not addressed by this bill?
Well, the our association doesn't take a position on that, but in terms of economics, certainly any bit of energy we can save is a plus. And I think hybrid vehicles, for example, the oil industry is participating in a partnership with the government and with automobile manufacturers to try to develop hybrid vehicles. And I think when we look out there in the world and look at the increase in the demand for oil, especially in places like China and India, which is a large part of the reason why we're seeing higher prices today for crude oil, that technology holds a lot of promise for the future, and I think that that's one of the ways we're going to be going quickly, sooner rather than later.
Bill Prindle, I talked earlier about a balance between current types of energy supplies and alternatives. There are incentives for ethanol in this bill. The corn producers, the farmers like that a lot. How does the petroleum industry feel about it?
Well, we thought the overall, the final amount they ended up with was more than what the petroleum industry wanted. It was 7.5 million barrels, and we had wanted less than that because it actually forces refiners to use more ethanol than they need to make the cleaner fuels, and that doesn't enforce a cost on them. So, and also we were very disappointed that they did not go for a national phase out of the additive MTBE. That's something the industry had supported, and it didn't pass in Congress. And that really ties our hands in terms of needing some certainty going forward in the future. If you have this sort of piecemeal where individual states ban MTBE, it makes it harder to bring product to market, and it reduces flexibility in the marketplace. So that was a major disappointment as well.
MTBE, as I understand it, an additive originally put into gasoline and required to be in gasoline as a way of providing a cleaner burning fuel. But it turns out that it leaks out of tanks and pollutes water supplies, as I understand it. As I understand it, your concern at the Petroleum Institute is you don't want to have to pay for the consequences of that, given that it was forced upon the industry in the first place. Is that roughly right?
No, it's not, actually. It was a very narrow provision, and it had to do with just liability for the product itself, not for the cleanup at all. Companies were never seeking that, and they are responsible and are cleaning that up. This was just a defective product liability. It was to protect them from being sued for using the product to begin with, since Congress is actually the one that mandated the use of this product. So it's a kind of a catch-22, and it's that particular aspect of it, the liability portion, not for the cleanup, not in any way at all for that, but just protection from being sued for having used it to begin with, not for cleaning up any spills.
Once again, Ray Dewar.
That's a disappointment.
Excuse me. Okay, Ray Dewar again, the manager of energy market issues for the American Petroleum Institute. The glass is either half full or half empty, depending on how you look at it. Better than nothing is the bottom line for them. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we'll be talking with the League of Conservation Voters. We'll also be talking about energy security with regard to our position and vulnerability to the dependence on foreign oil. Has that been addressed by the new bill? On Reporter's Notebook, the IRA says it will lay down its arms. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Mormon Elney back with To the Point, talking today about the energy bill, which has passed the Congress today, 275-156, a similar margin is expected in the Senate, and President Bush is hoping that he can sign this bill by the weekend. Again, it's 1,700 pages long, contains $12.3 billion in incentives for various industries. We're talking about the balance and how it works out. We've heard from the American Petroleum Institute and the Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Tiernan Sittenfeld speaks for the League of Conservation Voters, legislative director for that organization. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier, we heard from the American Petroleum Institute, the glass is half empty or half full, depending on how you look at it. How do you look at it?
We definitely think the glass is half empty in this case, unfortunately. We believe that Americans deserve a smarter, cleaner energy policy that reduces our dependence on polluting energy sources, that safeguards natural resources, and that significantly increases energy efficiency and renewable energy. And unfortunately, the energy bill that the House has just voted on will accomplish none of these goals and will, in fact, damage public health, the environment, and our pocketbooks. And I would say, you know, overall, we think this is an energy bill that's unsuitable for the last century, let alone for the 21st century, and we certainly urge the Senate to vote against it.
All right. Very strong criticisms. What particularly is wrong with it? Is it what's in it or what's not in it?
They're both. There are plenty of harmful things in it. You know, the bill has environmental rollbacks for the Safe Drinking Water Act. It has exemptions for the oil and gas industry from cleaning up their pollution, which would undermine the Clean Water Act. It repeals the Public Utility Holding Company Act, or PUCA, which is the main law to protect consumers from market manipulation, fraud, and abuse in the electricity sector. So those are some of the problems with the bill. In addition, it would basically help line the pockets of the oil and gas industry, which are already making record profits. Just today, for example, ExxonMobil released its profits for the second quarter of 2005, and they rose 32% over the previous quarter. So these definitely are not the companies that need to be having more profits when regular people, ratepayers and taxpayers, are not getting any relief from this bill.
Okay. We don't have people to respond to all of your criticisms. We do, however, still have Ray Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute. Let me go back to her. What do you say about record profits, and why is the industry asking for incentives at a time when that's the case?
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about these earnings of the industry. When you look at the industry, especially in the most recent quarter, the earnings are about slightly above average compared to the rest of the U.S. industry. They earned about 7.9 cents on the dollar. The rest of the U.S. earned 7.5 cents. These profits have to be put in context of what companies are spending to bring product to market. So when you look at it that way or measure it that way, in the past 5 years, the industry has made about a nickel and a half on every dollar of sales. So has the rest of U.S. industry. So that's a perspective. And in terms of giveaways, there really aren't any giveaways to the oil industry in this bill at all. There are a few small tax incentives, and they're for marginal producers in the Gulf to help make us more competitive with our competition abroad. And it's really to help natural gas production in the Gulf of Mexico, and especially use some of this new technology to get to the mature fields in really deep water areas where they're already developing. They're trying to get the last little bit out. And in order to do this, they do have those incentives. But that's just it's a fairly marginal amount. And when you look at the breakout of who's getting what in these tax incentives, it's pretty marginal for oil and gas. The $2.6 billion out of the $14.5 billion, $1 million of that $2.6 billion, or $1 billion of it, goes to natural gas transmission lines to bring natural gas to homes. So you end up with a net amount of $1.6 billion for oil and gas. And on the flip side of it, the industry is pouring in an additional $1.6 billion into the oil spill fund over and above what they had done in the past. So it's kind of a wash in terms of incentives for the industry.
Okay, Ray Dewar,
marginal.
Once again with the American Petroleum Institute. Tiernan Suttenfeld with the League of Conservation Voters. How do you respond to all that?
Well, I would respond just in terms of the specific subsidy issue. The nuclear power incentives alone are $7.3 billion, which is astounding. But then there are far, you know, many other problems with this energy bill beyond the giveaways to polluting industries.
Well, wait a minute. Back to what we heard specifically about the giveaways. Ray Dewar says they aren't giveaways, and that you said there were record profits. She says 7.9% on the dollar, as opposed to an average of 7.5, with roughly a nickel on the dollar over the past few years. So, how do you react specifically to that? And does that coincide with your comment about record profits?
Well, I think the numbers speak for themselves in terms of the record profits that ExxonMobil, for example, released today. And then in terms of analyses from environmental groups who have looked at the bill, it provides more than twice as many tax breaks to the nuclear, coal, oil, and gas industry as it does to clean alternatives and to energy efficiency. And that's really the problem with this bill. It's a backward-looking bill. We need to take better advantage of American ingenuity and know-how. The Senate did try to have some bright spots in its bill, which, as Bill mentioned, weren't included. For example, the 10% renewable energy standard. The Senate had attempted to address the threat of global warming, to reduce oil imports. None of that was included in the final bill. So this is, again, very disappointing. It's bad for consumers and public health, and it takes us backwards on critical environmental protections.
Okay. I want to go back and remind our listeners that this bill is 1,700 pages long and has so many provisions in it that it's very difficult to get your mind around the entire thing. There's no way in the world we're going to be able to debate these things piece by piece. But let me ask you, Tiernan Sittenfeld, why you seem to be saying that nuclear energy and clean coal are not adequately are not really alternatives to oil and gas. Is that right?
No, I'm sort of lumping all of those things in terms of those are more mature traditional sources of energy, and we really need to be looking to the future to energy efficiency and vehicle incentives. As I believe was mentioned earlier, for example, there was a big opportunity for the Senate to do a simple, straightforward thing by increasing miles per gallon standards for cars. They declined the opportunity to do that as well. So, again, just another example of where this is not a forward-looking progressive bill for the 21st century.
Well, so nuclear and coal, then, are not going to be ways of clean coal, I should say, ways of trying to phase out of the oil and gas economy in a way that helps with global warming, for example. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that we don't need to be providing subsidies to these industries, which are experiencing great profits, and that we should instead be looking to new technology, renewable efficiency, and new technologies that are out there that could actually benefit greatly from increased funding.
What about wind? It's my understanding there are subsidies for wind energy in the bill.
There are definitely, and again, this is an example of where the Senate bill was more forward-thinking than the House passed bill, but unfortunately, in the final conference report, the majority of the tax breaks and the subsidies are not for renewables. There are definitely some in there, and we support that.
Do you think there's any chance that the Senate will make an attempt to change this bill? You said that you hoped that the Senate would vote it down. It is, as you pointed out, a final conference bill between the two houses. Don't you think it's pretty likely the Senate's going to go along?
Well, it did pass the House today. We're certainly talking to senators, pointing out to them, as you said, the bill is 1,700 pages, so I think at least the Senate should have an opportunity to read the bill, to see what's in it, to see that this is not the kind of bill that's going to take us forward, reduce our dependence on oil, make us more, increase our national security, provide consumers relief at the pump. It's just not going to do that, and we're conveying that message to senators throughout the day and for the rest of the week.
Okay. Tiernan Sittenfeld, once again, Legislative Director for the League of Conservation Voters. The issue of independence on foreign oil is a national security issue as well as one that has to do with economics. Frank Gaffney is a former Pentagon official, heads the Center for Security Policy in Washington. And Mr. Gaffney, on prior programs, I know you've indicated you think this is a major concern. Do you think that the energy bill, as passed by the House, addresses it?
I'm afraid it does not, Warren. I think that clearly there are steps being taken that will improve various aspects of our energy posture and I guess fall into the category, therefore, of glass half full viewers of this bill. Having said that, clearly we face a national security emergency as a result of our dependence upon oil, much of which comes from places that are at best unstable, and it was downright hostile to us, some of whom provide the revenues from their oil sales to us and others to terrorists, some of whom are blowing up the infrastructure upon which we rely. And indeed, in addition to all of that, you have the growing appetite of communist China. This means, it seems to me, that this legislation, and if not this legislation, certainly new legislation that comes on its heels, must urgently address the problem that arises really principally from the use we make in our transportation sector of oil, much of it from overseas. And this bill, I think, does not do nearly enough. There are a few things that are helpful, but not nearly enough, and certainly not in a comprehensive and urgent way to address what is, as I say, I think, a national security emergency.
What about efforts to make it easier for oil and gas companies to develop domestic sources of energy? Is that part of this bill, and does that go at least some of the way toward the security issue?
Well, I believe there are incentives, and previous guests have debated this point, whether they need to be there or not at these prices. Even President Bush seemed to think that it was not necessary, but I believe there are nonetheless incentives built into this bill. A friend of mine said, calls this the sum of all lobbies, so they're very well represented. But I would simply say that the future lies with non-oil sources of transportation energy that can come as plug-in hybrids, tap into the electrical grid, sources of fuel for which could be, as you've said, wind or nuclear or clean coal, natural gas. Very little of it is currently generated from oil. We can be using flexible fuels, alternatives to gasoline based on alcohol products, ethanol, and not purely corn-based ethanol, but cellulosic ethanol and methanol. These are things that we can produce in this country. Just recently, CAFTA has been passed by the House and Senate. I think that's a very good thing. One of its upshots should be to create a new Saudi Arabia in Latin America and the Caribbean, producing ethanol from sugarcane. Brazil currently relies on that very heavily for its transportation sector. There's no reason why we can't be obtaining alternatives to oil from our own hemisphere. In all of these ways, I think we could be doing vastly more, and frankly, we are going to have no choice but to do vastly more if, as I fear, oil simply ceases to be available, particularly imported oil, as it has been in the past, at anything like the costs we've seen.
How soon do you think that's likely to become a problem?
It could happen tomorrow. It's been pointed out that there are sulfur clearing towers in Saudi Arabia that could be taken out with a single mortar round, dropping 6 million barrels off the market. Will it happen? I don't know. Could it happen? Absolutely. Would that create a crisis? I think it would. Could it be compounded by refineries being taken down in this country, by tankers being blown up, port offload facilities? Could you have a trauma in the oil importing sector? I think there's no doubt about it. And frighteningly, terrorists have understood the vulnerability of our economy to such attacks. So I think we have to be about, much more urgently than this bill does, the business of giving us alternatives to oil, particularly imported oil. And that would be my principal critique of this legislation.
Frank Affney, formerly with the Pentagon, now at the Center for Security Policy. Back to Ray Dewar at the American Petroleum Institute. Is the foreign supply of oil in as fragile a condition as Mr. Gaffney suggests?
Well, only one respect, the supply and the demand, the difference between the two is very thin right now in the world, and that's why we see prices as high as they are. And we also have a strategic petroleum reserve designed just for such an emergency. Should there be a big disruption in supply, that we could bring some on right away. But the point that I think he's really missing is that we are in an interdependent world. We are tied into this global economy. We're part of this economy. And the current high prices we're experiencing have more to do with the demand than they have to do with any supplier out there. All suppliers are really breaking their necks to get enough supply to the marketplace. We need more access here in the United States, and these prices are certainly providing a lot of incentive to produce more abroad. So it's a mistake to think that we can somehow duck our heads and not be part of this global economy. We are part of it, and the best thing that we can do is to recognize that we live in an interdependent world and actually enhance the ties between producers and consumers rather than try to sever them, because it really wouldn't help us at all. The price we pay is a price that's determined on a world market, so it really doesn't matter who you buy the crude from or even where you produce it, other than jobs that we would have here at home and keeping some of that income here.
Mr. Gaffney, a quick response to that, if you will.
Well, that's, I'm afraid, not the future. It may have been the past. The future is one that I think is going to be much more likely to be subjected to disruptions from people who wish to do us harm. And we've put a blueprint together to try to give the American people an alternative. It's called Set America Free at setamericafree.org, and I would encourage people to take a look at it, because I think it offers an alternative to a world in which we are increasingly dependent upon unreliable people, people who wish to do us harm, and going up against increasing demand at a time when supply may be not increasing by anything like the dimensions it needs to. This is the kind of, I think, world in which sensible policymakers need to be much more assertive about creating alternatives to oil. And I wish the Congress will get about it. I hope they will come
to fall. Frank Gaffney again with the Center for Security Policy. Attorney Sittenfeld, back to you with the League of Conservation Voters. We are almost out of time, but I want to read you just a brief excerpt from an editorial in the Dallas Morning News, hardly a liberal paper in a very conservative state, saying that this bill is a reality check. There will be, for energy independence, a hefty price and tribute to traditional energy producers. And the one thing that might shift that reality, it says, is a national security breach of horrendous proportions. Do you have a sense that in the Congress it will take an emergency of the sort that Frank Gaffney is talking about to get a different kind of approach to energy?
I think already the American people want a different approach to energy. They want to have clean air. They want to have wild space, open space. And so they know that we need to go in a different direction that focuses more on energy efficiency and renewable technology. And I think the public is conveying that to Congress. And although the House passed the bill today, we know that Congress is going to, you know, is going to recognize that, that this bill was not the answer and that we do need to look to a new clean energy future.
Very quickly, let me go back to Bill Prindle with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. It was in the first part of our program. What do you say about the security issue? And do you think that ultimately that might be what decides energy policy in the United States?
Well, certainly the 1973-74 oil shock had a riveting effect on Congress, and that's why you saw in 1975 and 76 the most significant energy legislation we've ever had in the United States. It really was transformative. I think, sad to say, that it will take a huge shock of either political, military, or economic proportions to change the dynamic in Congress.
Okay, we are going to leave it at that for the moment. We'll come back, talk about this on other programs. But thanks to all of you, Bill Prindle with the Council on Energy Efficient Economy, Ray Dewar with the American Petroleum Institute, Tiernan Sittenfeld with the League of Conservation Voters, and Frank Gaffney with the Center for Security Policy. The Irish Republican Army says it'll end its campaign of armed conflict and pursue independence from Britain by peaceful means. Prime Minister Tony Blair calls it a step of unparalleled magnitude. Have 35 years of bloody fighting come to an end? More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manalini back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The IRA's pledge to end its campaign of violence came first in a DVD released to reporters. That was followed by an announcement in Dublin by Gerry Adams, who leads Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army.
There is a huge responsibility on us all to seize this moment and to make Irish freedom a reality. And I would urge all Irish nationalists and Republicans and others, including those who have shown such commitment as volunteers in the IRA, to put their undoubted talents and energy into building a new Ireland.
Gerry Adams speaking today in Dublin. Dan Keenan is in Belfast, where he is a Northern News editor for the Irish Times. Dan, the Prime Minister said today, although he indicated, as I said earlier, that this was a step of unparalleled magnitude, that there have been false dawns and dashed hopes in the past. Why is this announcement being taken so seriously?
Well, Warren, I think it's the significance, it's the scale of the announcement made today by the IRA. They have announced cessations of violence in the past. They have announced ceasefires as long ago as 1994 and more recently in 1997. But not since 1962 and the previous IRA campaign have we heard a declaration that they are going to put down their arms and commit themselves to a purely democratic and peaceful future. That's what sets this statement apart from previous ones.
What are the skeptics saying about it?
The skeptics are saying, we'll believe it when we see it. And that's basically how it all boils down, Warren. What has happened is that many in Northern Ireland, and especially here in Belfast, in the unionist community who want to retain the link between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, they say, we'll make up our minds on this as soon as we see the colour of the IRA's money, because we've had statements from them before, we've heard fine words about committing to a peaceful future and working for democracy and justice, but off and on we've had too many breakdowns in law and order, we've had the IRA's campaign of violence being restarted time and again. So they're going to take a skeptical view on this until such times as they see all the IRA's weapons being put beyond use, as they say, and that they are that they have clearly and demonstrably stood down their army and committed completely to democratic politics.
How far has the IRA gone today in that direction that makes you and others, particularly the Prime Minister, say that this seems to be so much more significant than the other things that we've seen in the past?
I think we have seen so many statements in the past from the IRA. We know they've been building up towards this for quite some time. Today is a departure from statements that they have made in the past, as I've already said.
Mm-hmm.
And we are now seeing this not so much as an end in itself, Warren. We're seeing this as the first step in a series of events which we're expecting to see between now and the end of the year. So I would say in the next week, the next couple of weeks perhaps, we would expect to see movement to dispose of the substantial dump of arms and bombs that the IRA already has, and to see other initiatives which is proving that it is going to move conclusively in a democratic trend. That's what we're expecting, and today is step one. It's the beginning of a process, certainly not the end of it just yet.
How do you measure that? Does anybody really know how extensive the arsenal of arms and bombs really is?
Well, it's a difficult question, and it's certainly one that members of the unionist political community that I've already referred to here, it's a question that will be foremost in their minds. What the two governments have done here, and they have the backing of the U.S. administration and indeed previous administrations in this, there are a number of bodies here which will monitor paramilitary activity. There's another group which is specifically designed to oversee the decommissioning of IRA weapons, and there are a host of other watchdogs and bodies which are going to keep an eye on things and will report to the two governments and to the people of Ireland and indeed people elsewhere as well to tell us how things are progressing. And it's on the basis of their reports and on their good word that political developments will be based.
Will it take some very specific demonstrable action by the IRA to restart the process of negotiations about power sharing in Northern Ireland?
Yes, I think it will. We've already touched on the weapons side. They have a job of work to do on that issue. They also need to commit, as far as the British-Irish governments are concerned, they need to commit themselves to supporting the police service here in Northern Ireland. That is something they have not done so. And they say the two governments are insisting that if they are to support fundamentally the peace agreement signed here in 1998, that's the Good Friday Agreement, then they have to also endorse all the arms of state here, and that includes the police service, which they do not support. They're going to have to commit to that, and there's going to be some discussions in the autumn, I understand, trying to bring Sinn Féin in and get them part of the new policing dispensation here. That's going to be a key issue.
In the aftermath of the transit bombings recently in London, there have been comparisons to bombings by the IRA. What about the timing of this, and to what extent do you think it was designed to come at this moment to take advantage in some way of what's happened in the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think the timing today, Warren, is very significant. Gerry Adams, remember, made a call to the IRA to consider adopting a purely political strategy as far back as April the 6th. Now, obviously, the London bombings have taken place since then. But there has been no doubt that this process of consultation among the ranks of the IRA is taking place in the context of a post-9/11 world. I had a private interview with the British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Mr. Peter Hayne, earlier this afternoon, and he was saying, you know, we live in a different society now. We live in a different world now. This is not 1969 when the street violence erupted again on the streets of Belfast. This is a world, you know, where we have suicide bombers in the streets of London. This is the world post-9/11. There is just no tolerance for paramilitary activity anywhere in the world, and especially in a European democracy. And that's the climate in which today's statement should be seen.
The IRA famously is involved in criminal operations, armed robbery, smuggling, money laundering, partly to gather funds for the political organization. But what about the possibility of it breaking up into small, independent criminal gangs in the future?
I think this is always a danger whenever you have an organization such as the IRA. Whenever it is stood down, what does it then go and do? One of the lines in the IRA statement released earlier today says that all former volunteers, that's members of the IRA, must not engage in any form of activity whatsoever. And that is being seen almost universally as a calling off of all criminal operations as well. There is a danger, of course, that that some people will walk away, will do their own thing, and may use the influence that they have in society to further their own ends. We're going to have to wait and see on that one. But such has been the length of the consultation that the IRA has had since April, and such has been the depth of that consultation. I don't think Gerry Adams and the IRA would have stepped up to the microphone and made an announcement like they did today, unless they were fairly sure that they could maintain their discipline.
Okay.
I don't honestly think that it's a major risk. It's certainly a possibility, but I don't think it's a major risk.
Dan Keenan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Northern News editor for the Irish Times, speaking to us today from Belfast. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.